Right. Well, welcome everybody. Thanks so much for joining us. For you in the room, but also everybody online, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. And we're delighted to have this event today where we're discussing how communities engage with armed actors and what the implications are for external actors. We specifically looked at humanitarian peace and protection actors, knowing that there are a range of both those internal to communities, but also external, that are trying to support and facilitate dialogue towards reducing violence. My name's Gemma Davis. I'm a senior research fellow with the Humanitarian Policy Group, part of ODI. And to give a quick background of this discussion, we've been carrying out over 2 years worth of research in order to look at this subject of community engagement with armed actors and the implications for humanitarian peace and protection actors. Have recently released, looking at Central African Republic and then releasing a report last week on South Sudan. And we're delighted to have a range of experts with deep experience to discuss their own experience towards supporting communities in their own dialogue with armed actors towards reducing violence. And we really hope that this will be an interactive discussion today, both from you in the room, but also those online. Before we go ahead, a few housekeeping rules. So for those online, to access French translation, please click on the globe at the bottom of the screen, and the closed captions can also be accessed that way. And once we've heard from our panelists, we'd love to have your questions and your comments. Feel free to put your thoughts and reflections for those online in the chat box, but also use the Q&A box. And just a reminder that the event is being recorded and the video will be available on the event webpage in a couple of days' time. So without further ado, let me introduce our panelists. So first of all, we have Lee Mayhew, who has been working with us on the project for the last 2 years, also part of ODI. We have Kennedy Fumutu-Jereze. Sorry for the pronunciation. My pronunciation is awful. So Kennedy is the director of Conciliation Resources East and Central Africa Programme, overseeing programmes in the Central Africa Republic, DRC, South Sudan, Northwestern Kenya, and Uganda. And he's worked on a number of peace-building issues, including civil-military relations, community-led peace-building, disarmament and reintegration, of former combatants into civilian life, mediation, as well as having facilitated talks between the Ugandan government and Uganda National Rescue Front. And he has many years' experience across both donor organizations as well as NGOs. Then we also have from Nonviolent Peace Force to the far right here, to my far right, is Johan Sashimang, the team leader of Unity State in South Sudan, and Yuchaya Niall, the National Protection Officer from Juba IDP camps in South Sudan. So Johan has been working in humanitarian protection and peace building programs for the last 15 years in Sri Lanka and South Sudan, and is currently working on civilian protection issues in South Sudan. And Yuchaya has been working in the humanitarian sector for 7 years in South Sudan, focusing on protection and peace building in multiple conflict affected areas. Online, we have a colleague, Ungenan Koulibaly, who is a protection advisor for NRC in Central and Western Africa region. He's based in Dakar, Senegal, with regular visits and support to country offices in Nigeria, Burkina Faso, Niger, Mali, DRC, and CAR, and has over 17 years' experience in implementing and managing humanitarian programs in several NGOs. And last but very much not least, we have Reverend Peter Tibiwit here. Reverend Peter is the Executive Director of Reconcile, which is a faith-based internet organization working for peace building and conflict mediation in South Sudan and the region, the former Secretary General of the South Sudan Council of Churches, an ecumenical body with international linkages, and has over 30 years' experience as a mediator. So we have a really rich panel here today, and we're really excited for this discussion. But without further ado, we're going to start the discussion with a quick overview of what we found through the research, and then we'll go to our panelists. So Lee, over to you.
Well, thank you, Gemma, and good morning to everyone in the room and online, and thank you for joining us. So I'll start with the story so far of our research. So we began with the fact that there's strong evidence of a protection gap, and there are three issues at stake. Firstly, there isn't enough focus on what communities are already doing. There's also, humanitarian action is often after harm has occurred rather than focus on prevention of violence. And we're still seeing a siloed approach between peace building, protection, and humanitarian action. So in terms of the background then for the research, you know, what we were interested in trying to find out and dig more into was firstly focus on how communities engage with armed actors, the factors that affect their engagement with armed actors, and also the opportunities, challenges, and risks associated with external support. Some of you might already be aware that we documented some of our early findings from the scoping study in the humanitarian exchange number 82, which is outside and also available online. And we've also, as Gemma said, published two case studies. Firstly, one on the Central African Republic in October last year, and this was in collaboration with Peace and Development Watch. And more recently, the case study on South Sudan. And this was with our partners at the Bridge Network. And again, these are available online. So what we found? Well, firstly, communities strategically engage with armed actors, and this is in terms of who represents them, what they engage on, when they engage, and also utilizing available leverage over armed actors to initiate dialogue. Individuals often have specific qualities. They're able to remain calm, they're experienced, they're persuasive, and are often drawn from positions of moral respect. Faith and spiritual leaders often lead dialogue on behalf of communities. Faith institutions historically instill respect and therefore a sense of trust and neutrality. They also have the advantage of strong networks, and they can link both local to national dialogue and also can utilize and leverage their international networks. There is a key role for women to play in dialogue with armed actors. They're able to leverage perceptions that they're non-threatening and their symbolic role of a maternal authority, portraying themselves as mothers and also sons, they have having sons across all sides. But we also must remember that they can also be instigators of violence. They also carry certain specific risks during dialogue. And sometimes they can have little choice in terms of the role they play within dialogue. And finally, both external and internal factors influence the engagement process. And this is in terms of, you know, the level of social cohesion we see within communities, the type of armed actor that communities are engaging with, and also the impact of conflict dynamics. So what does this mean? Well, from what we've learned from current practice in terms of the roles for external actors in supporting dialogue to reduce violence, firstly, external interventions can undermine community-level efforts. This means that external support should not ignore what communities are already achieving by themselves and should respect their agency in engaging armed actors. So this means organizations should firstly understand existing community dynamics, approaches, and mechanisms, and they should build from this, whilst also recognizing and respecting norms, values, and traditions. Also, facilitating community-based dialogue is a critical entry point to strengthening complementary approaches between humanitarian and peace-building action, which can have a profound outcome in terms of reducing and interrupting escalations of violence. But care must be taken to bring in representatives which have genuine authority and influence, recognizing that while inclusivity is crucial, a representative approach is not necessarily inclusive. Also, via their toolkit, in collaboration with peace actors, humanitarians are able to influence the calculations over the use of violence. So what do these roles require? Well, firstly, it requires conflict and community stakeholder analysis and conflict sensitivity analysis at the micro-local level. This is something which humanitarian actors can learn from the approaches and methodology of peace actors. Also, this analysis needs to be part of a system which is able to inform programming approaches and decision-making. Also, we need to be honest in terms of the role that humanitarian assistance can and often does play in terms of forming a part of the political economy of armed conflict and being co-opted. It also requires building trust through the presence and long-term sustained support to communities. And finally, it requires an approach that is flexible, adaptable, and willing to take risks. This means a move away from rigid, predefined program design with predetermined results, and which often carry unrealistic expectations and short-term timeframes. It also means a readiness to accept setbacks and failure and adapt to this. And also there needs to be a recognition that dialogue is a process, it is not a project. You know, it can't be measured by outputs and timeframes. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Lee. And I think that last quote, I think, is so powerful in some of the learning and the experience of so many of you and our panelists here today, that, you know, what does success look like? And the fact that dialogue is the process, not the project. And I think we can have a bit more discussion about that later. So Kennedy, first over to you. In your experience, what is the role of actors with peace building intent in situations of high intensity violence?
Thank you very much, Gemma. Maybe before coming to that question, let me give it a preamble for answering the question. Number one, we are seeing communities trapped in a self-perpetuating security dilemma. Presence of an armed group in an area creates insecurity that then necessitates communities to mobilize to fight insecurity. And in the end, you have mushrooming and multiple armed actors operating in the same space. This is the experience we are seeing in Central African Republic, to a large extent in DRC, and to a large extent in South Sudan. We are also seeing a very big disconnect between the localized drivers of violence and the issues articulated by the senior commanders, but also the political group in that particular location. Number three, we have seen that there is a complex interaction because of familial and other networks between civilians, armed actors. Therefore, the distinction between civilians and armed actors is most of the time very hard. As my colleague Numari jokes, he says it's about the extent. Are you 70, 100% full-time member of an armed actor, armed group, or you are 1%, in which case you are coerced, or you are anywhere in between? So given that this is the reality that we are dealing with, coming back to your question, what do we see then as the role of peace building actors? We see number one, I would say it's about the intention. What's the goal that we intend to achieve? The goal may not be immediate, it may be long-term. For example, intending to engage this particular group in dialogue. But to do that, you need to establish trust. So by engaging with armed groups, your intention or the intention of the peace builder is to aim at a non-violent end or ending the conflict through dialogue. But to do that, you need to first establish rapport and communication and dialogue with this armed group. That's the first. The second, I would see a peace builder or individuals with peace building intent as being a conduit and a channel of communication between the armed groups and for example, government, for example, the externals, for example, other actors in the area. The third is about negotiating access. We've seen, for example, in the Central African Republic, individuals with peace-building intent, for example, negotiating a non-aggression pact between different armed groups operating in the same city, or negotiating access, for example, to move from point A to point B. And this tend to be around, for example, a service which all of them need, like access to a medical facility, access to a religious institution, access to, you know, for traders to bring in goods in and out of the city. So we've seen peace building actors engaging and negotiating these elements. And I think, in my opinion, these are the three elements, or among the elements, or among the areas where peace building actors can make a contribution. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Kennedy. And I think I remember when we talked probably a couple of years ago, and I think this point about the extent of civilianness is such a important point to then build on, whether you're a peace builder, whether you're a humanitarian actor that are trying to support communities, where that bridge is for dialogue. So really important points. Thank you. Johan, over to you. So tell us, from a nonviolent peace force perspective, what's unique to nonviolent peace force's approach to working with communities to reduce violence? What needs to be considered by external actors when supporting those communities in their attempts to reduce violence?
Thank you, Jemma. Thank you for having me here. Yes, nonviolent peace force, what is unique with us is about unarmed civilian protection methodology, which we are using to build peace side by side along with the local communities. And we advocate for wider adoption of this unarmed strategies to safeguard the humanity and also the dignity of the community. So I'm pretty sure most of you might heard about unarmed civilian protection. So it's a mix of unarmed strategies which we are using, especially in the context of violent conflicts, and as well as, like, for instance, to interrupt the cycle of violence, as well as to enhance the nonviolent efforts responses to the conflict. So that's our key unique aspects of our programs using unarmed civilian protection strategies. So going back to the second point, what Jemma was asking about, like, what need to be considered. So actually, when it comes to dialogues, it's a process. So basically, we have to do sort of like in-depth context and the conflict analysis to understand the conflict, the community dynamics. So this will help really for us to understand various multiple parties who are involved in the conflict, and same time to understand about their interest, the needs. So this needs more on a relationship building. So that's one of the key aspects in our programs, in our interventions. So to understand the status, like basically to find out entry points where we can enter to support the communities in facilitating dialogues. So as you all know, that community, they have their own strategies of solving their problems, issues. So we need to identify the local existing structures. So identifying existing structures, so we'll be able to support if necessary for them to mediate or to come to resolution of the conflict. So that's very important for our work to build up the relationship with the communities. So this is where we'll be able to engage with multiple parties and bring them to a one space with a common goal.
Yep. Perfect. Thank you so much. And I think sort of that emphasis on the process, the entry points, the relationship to the needed, so important. We'll go to the line now with Ungenan. So Ungenan, can you tell us about what the NRC experiences on mediation from a humanitarian perspective, and the outcomes and the opportunities of such approaches?
Thank you, Gemma. Good morning, everybody. In terms of experience of ANASI in humanitarian mediation, just to let you know, ANASI is implementing humanitarian mediation program since 2017 in three countries: Central African Republic, Democratic Republic of Congo, and in Mali. And we did the first project since from 2017 and to 2020. Through that project, we aimed at preventing and interrupting violence against civilians. And at the end of the project, an external evaluation was conducted in 2020 to learn from the project in order to improve the programming and define any potential future direction for humanitarian mediation in ANASI. And secondly, this evaluation was also intended to contribute to building the broader knowledge of on humanitarian mediation through its funding being shared among relevant actors with an interest to enhance proactive protection. The evaluation conducted that on the humanitarian action, mediation action delivered strong building. The evaluation concluded that we were able to deliver strong peace building results, and that there were opportunities to further strengthen the model as an emergency protection measure. That recommendation were taken on board during another phase of humanitarian mediation initiative we conducted in 2021 to 2022 with the development of a methodology for an emergency mediation processes. So we were able during this last project to deliver some mediation processes in emergency context for facilitating communication and collaboration between conflict parties to help them find by themselves mutually acceptable solution. And what we are doing in the three countries by now is to ensure that to preserve the outcome of mediation processes we achieved, we have been able to strengthen our participation in social cohesion working groups in countries to better communicate on our processes and ensure a handover to peace building actors for longer interventions. In terms of outcome and opportunities of such approach, through mediation processes, our program aimed at improving safety and security for civilians and improve understanding between parties to the mediation in targeted areas. Across the three countries in which we have developed the program, Mali, DRC, and also CAR, more than two-thirds of community members we asked reported feeling safer and more secure at the end of the initiative, with a similar number of participants reporting a positive change in their relationship with the other participants. In addition, we saw that we were able to prevent and interrupt some instance of violence and preventing forced displacement and facilitating voluntary returns. And we were also able to improve access of vulnerable populations to basic services. And above all, we were able also to enhance respect of human rights. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thanks, Ngannan. I think some really interesting questions that we've certainly been asking ourselves on sort of where does the role of humanitarians and peace builders ideally start-stop layer, and maybe we can go a bit into that later on. Reverend Tibby, you've just come from carrying out a mediation. So can you tell us from your rich, you know, decades of experience about how you support dialogue with communities and armed actors to reduce violence and what's needed for positive outcomes?
Thank you. With us in the room here, we have prominent people who have worked for many years. Professor Peter Tingwa is here, that have worked for many years, can testify. First of all, as a faith-based organization, there are two things we require. One, we require a mandate from conflicting parties, whether communities or armed actors, for us to get engaged. Out of the mandate, we can be able to look for resources that can facilitate us in that process. Second, we look for clearance from armed actors that we can be able to move without being suspected as a collaborator. So after getting these mandates and clearance, then we can be able to engage. One, we engage through bringing the conflicting parties together to dialogue, or first we use what we call quiet diplomacy. Quiet diplomacy is we use it for subtle diplomacy for the conflicting parties to come to cessation of hostility. When cessation of hostility is done, then we can be able to now facilitate the actual reconciliations, peace building, and peaceful coexistence. Now, in the process, we bring all the stakeholders that are decision makers, whether women, youth, religious, armed actors together, to dialogue. Our work is only to play a role of facilitation. In the process, they agree on what they need to do. When they agree, we develop what we call peace charter, which they commit themselves, they sign, and we witness. These peace charters are implemented by all the communities, whether communities or armed groups have to implement what they've agreed on. And we reconcile, we follow up the agreement, what has been implemented and what has not been implemented and why. So it is a process, not a hit and run. Most organizations and others who are engaged, they do hit and run. One day, 3 days, they're gone. They don't come back. Ours, we have to follow it. Even if it takes a year, we have to see that there is sustainability of peace, of what we have done. So this makes what we do is sustainable. Now in the area, for example, in Yei area, some of you might not know where Yei area, there's been quite volatile. Up to now, there are even armed actors, non-signatories to the peace agreement in that areas, but our presence has created conducive environment for community to interact, for community to move, business to continue, and also return of refugees back to their own land, based on what we do as reconcile. Yes, 3 or 4 days ago, we've been facilitating a similar activities with one of the 8 different clans who have been fighting among themselves, including armed cattle herders. So we take a similar process of mediating and facilitating this process for peaceful coexistence. And at last, they have to come up with peace dividend, not only peaceful coexistence. What is this peace dividend that they can enjoy out of the peace they've made? So we cannot provide the peace dividend, but other NGOs can provide the peace dividend. From us, Reconcile, we do community or economic empowerment so that they can be able to be strong economically, support their family, support their children going to school, and be able to strong stand on their own. So this build peace that we do among communities that we have done in all parts of South Sudan. Lastly, when we do peace building, there's one element that always people forget, the trauma element. So you have to do trauma mixed with peace and reconciliation, because most of the conflicts are being fueled by trauma. You need to bring trauma element in the process so that you can be able to reach the end goal. Thank you.
Many thanks, Reverend Timmy. And I think it's such an important point that we've certainly sort of heard from, sort of incredibly experienced people and organizations that we've spoken with through the research around this role of trauma that so often seems to be forgotten or an afterthought. And I think something really important to consider, and this peace dividend part as well. I remember talking with you, but also other colleagues around sort of that dialogue is the starting point. But if there's no sort of follow-up and that longer term support, and what are those alternatives, and sort of really addressing some of those drivers of violence and why they keep carrying on, such important. And I think this is where maybe there's more of a conversation around, okay, you have the role of the peace builders, but it can't stop there. It has to continue with others coming in. And this is where I think we're really looking at that complementarity along between peace and peace building action towards humanitarian development action to come alongside. So I think some really, really important and necessary points there. Can we come back on, you sort of bridge this role as an insider and an outsider mediator. And what would you like to see happen from national, international peace, protection, humanitarian actors to support the efforts of communities and insider mediators to reduce violence? And also, are there things that these actors should not do?
I think it's very important to coordinate. Over these years, most of the peace actors and humanitarian actors work on their own. There's no coordination, there's no collaboration. There's need for coordination and collaboration. Second is the international actors or external actors are to strengthen the capacity of the insiders so that they can be able to provide the services needed in terms of protection, peace building, capacity strengthening is very important. The third one is to be conflict sensitive. Many times, certain activities exacerbate conflict instead of solving conflicts. We need to be conflict sensitive in what is done. And then the third one is we need to find out what is our exit strategy. We don't just leave people like that and then we get lost. We need to develop an exit strategy that is sustainable within the communities that we are serving. And I think that's what I can be able to say. Thank you.
Thanks very much. And I think it would be great to talk a little bit more. I know there are many of you online and in the room around this piece on conflict sensitivity and the harms that actually external action can do if it's not fully based on an in-depth analysis. Thank you so much. Kennedy, back to you. So what do you see as the optimal role of a peace actor or peace building actor or an actor with peace building intent vis-a-vis humanitarian actors when supporting communities to reduce violence? And have you seen any positive examples of collaborations in your experience?
Okay, thanks very much, Gemma. I'll start with maybe giving two practical examples from two projects where peace building and humanitarians work together, again, from Central African Republic. Like, for example, Conciliation Resources worked with War Child in Bosangwa, and it worked well. Then in another example, we've been working with Dan Church Aid, again in Central African Republic, where we've been integrating humanitarian, gender, trauma and peace building in one project. From these two projects and my other observation, it became apparent to me that this classification of humanitarian peace building, protection, human rights, it's more of an outsider construction. When you are coming to the conflict context as an outsider, and maybe because of your academic background, because of the mandate of your organization, it's easier to say, I'm in protection, I'm in peace building, I'm in human rights. But for the person living in the middle of this conflict, it's one and the same. That's why you will find that be it protection, humanitarian, peace building, we tend to engage with similar kind of local elites, the traditional leaders, the faith leaders, the nurses, the teachers in that particular conflict context. So from these two projects, I think that there should be strong complementarity between humanitarian and peace building, to come to your question. But number two, we should be collaborating even across the functions, the external, the internal, so that you have a same level of analysis. You are seeing the conflict with the same lenses, or we are using the same glass to read whatever is emerging in this context. So I would see the elements that the peace building person or person with peace building intent that can bring on the table is around, number one, analysis of the conflict, be it the drivers, be it the consequences, but also sniffing in the peace building opportunities that they are. Because sometimes we go into the context and then you see everything stuck and you're like, okay. So I think if you come in with peace building intent, then one of the cardinal roles should be to sniff out or sniff in the peace building opportunities and then work jointly to design strategies. Again, in these examples of the projects that we worked in, we found that, for example, humanitarian is one area where everybody is almost, where all the actors in the conflict are likely to agree because they will all be claiming to be protecting, fighting for the community, or working for the community. So we've seen that in the humanitarian angle is one area where you would see, say, non-state armed groups, governmental forces, government, communities likely to agree. So once there is disagreement, working with these stakeholders to do an analysis and then sniff out opportunities. The second element or part that I think the peace building, person with peace building intent can bring is to sort of build bridges across the conflict divide. Again, in example of CAR, given how the armed groups are structured, for example, and the response of the government, you see a lot of fragmentation along tribal, community, and other lines. So being able to negotiate access, building the gap, the bridge, and reaching out to the other side, for example, is one of the areas that I believe the peace building intent should be bringing on this type of collaboration. The third is, as I said, around negotiating access, for example, negotiating like non-aggression pacts, access to certain areas which may be difficult to reach, ensuring that there is an atmosphere and facilitating dialogue in communities, ensuring that we all have the same analysis, even though our mandates might be different as organization, but at least we all have clear analysis of the causes, the drivers, and what is pushing the conflict. If you can give me 1 minute. In all doing this, we need to be aware that the local actors will be at a far much considerable level of risk compared to the externals. And we need to make sure that we build in mechanisms of how we can interact and support these local actors. Then, of course, we need to remember the gender issues that are partly driving, but are also have been exacerbated by the conflict and violence. And also, we, as Reverend Tibi said, the issue of trauma needs to be factored. But most importantly, we need to collaborate and we need to work across the disciplines. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I think that that point is something maybe we should and should really sort of come back to and think through on this sort of risk side of things and what level of risk different individuals, actors, organizations are under, but also are there opportunities to share risk when working more in collaboration and complementarity? Something maybe we can come back to in the discussion. Let's, Nichaya, come back to you. I think we were talking a little bit earlier about, and Reverend Tibi was referring to the need to really have sort of decision makers, but also the right people around the table. So from your experience, who do you engage when facilitating dialogue? And importantly, how do you deal with spoilers, perpetrators of violence, those with an interest in perpetuating violence?
Thank you, Gemma. With the knowledge of knowing that the community, every community has a local structure. They have a local structure, for example, chiefs, local religious leaders, youth leaders, women leaders, and not forgetting the persons with special needs. So, you know, with that knowledge, it's always good to know that these are the specific people that you're supposed to be dealing with when facilitating a dialogue. Because these people are in charge of whatsoever that happens within the community. Everybody in the community sort of understand, I mean, like, respect these people so much. You as a facilitator, you're not moving with the solution when you're facilitating the dialogue. But the community has the solution to their own problem, to their own conflict. So keeping that in mind, these are the people that we deal with when it comes to facilitating a dialogue, the religious leaders, local authorities, for example, the chiefs, the women leaders, the youth leaders, and the persons with special needs. Not forgetting also, you know, these influential actors in the community. So that is when it comes to facilitating a dialogue, who we deal with. And then how we deal with the spoilers of violence or perpetrators of violence. So based on my experience working in South Sudan, we've been engaging with a number of armed actors. I wouldn't put it as soldiers or police, but these are community members who tend to also be spoilers or perpetrators of violence. So how we deal with them is, first of all, have an entry point, building relationship with these particular people. And how do we build the relationship? We sort of have closed door meetings with the perpetrators, you know, building relationship, because the moment you have closed door meetings with the perpetrators, when you're, you know, like, engaging them, you're going to them, you're building that relationship that will result into trust. Them telling you their interest, why they're doing what they're doing. And when they open up to you, this is where now you get the entry point on how you can further engage them. For example, giving them capacity buildings on how they can, maybe resolve conflict, how they shouldn't go ahead with the violence, and how they can, you know, like, have relationship with their own community. Because we've been engaging with youth that are known as, you know, negatively influenced youth. Because of the ongoing conflict in South Sudan, a lot of youth don't, you know, like, they're not associating with the community. So they tend to do negative. They do negative activities to the community where they come from. And how we deal with them is, you know, by engaging these youth, having closed door meetings, finding out their hiding places, going to their places, sort of, you know, this creates trust and relationship between the organization and the perpetrators. And then now when they tell you their interest, why they are doing what they are doing, if they are willing to meet the community, or maybe it's the community that is making them to behave the way they are behaving. Now, this is when you come back to the community and sort of, you know, like have tell them what exactly is happening with the youth. And then if there's room for mediation, if there's room for a dialogue, for them to come together, and then this is when you proceed with the dialogue or intervention, possible interventions. So yeah, Gemma.
Thank you so much. And I think it's really important, a couple of points that you made there on sort of this need to build relationships and trust, but also I think something that we found, particularly on sort of the specific role that nonviolent peace force play in sort of bridging between this humanitarian and peace building action. But so often humanitarian actors are reticent to engage with those that are perpetuating violence. And I think it's so critical, the reflections of all of you today on the need to do that if you really want to sort of go towards reducing violence and changing the calculations that armed actors and those engaging in violence make. So thank you so much on sort of, and that real need to sort of understand the interests and therefore identify the entry points. Ungenan, last but not least, back to you. So what do you see as the challenges and the risks of emergency mediation from a humanitarian perspective, including potential tensions with humanitarian principles?
Thank you, Gemma. Humanitarian mediation is a very great program to ensure that we can be able to prevent and interrupt violence against civilians. But there are many risks and challenges linked to this program we identified. Since 2017, we faced with many challenges in delivering humanitarian mediation processes. For example, ensuring compliance with the process required sufficient and adequate training of the humanitarian mediators, as well as well-established on the job coaching, mentoring, and supervision. This is both time and research intensive. We also know that in humanitarian programs, there are many turnover of staff, the staffing. So the turnover within the teams with the regular departure of the staff remain a very great challenge, knowing that conducting a mediation process required a minimum of training. The risk aversion of humanitarian actors, which tend to withdraw from the front line where humanitarian mediation has the potential of having the largest impact on preventing and interrupting violence and displacement. We also know that measuring improvement in safety and security and monitoring protection outcome is highly complex and requires substantial effort in terms of monitoring and evaluation, capacity building and researches. Humanitarian mediation, as you can, you know, compared to another humanitarian program expertise, humanitarian mediation is a new program and building donors' interest in order to mobilize financial research remain a huge challenge. Humanitarian mediation includes also processes, and women involvement is a very complex in some contexts. For example, in Central Sahel, is very, 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 very difficult to ensure the inclusion of women in the humanitarian mediation processes. In terms of risk, There are several risks identified and associated with conducting the humanitarian mediation processes. For example, physical risk to humanitarian mediators deployed in a volatile context is real. Intimidation of stakeholders in the process. Conducting the humanitarian mediation process, you can have some stakeholders, including part of the process, who can be intimidated by the another stakeholders. And there is the high possible of escalation of the conflict if you do not ensure a deep conflict analysis to ensure that you have a very broad and deep knowledge about the conflict and its possible escalation factors. So these risks can be in large part mitigated through communication and strict compliance with the steps of the humanitarian mediation processes and adherence to the humanitarian principles. This involves, but is not limited to, conducting a deep conflict sensitive analysis prior to conduct the process, not triggering a weak commitment to the process by paying incentives. That is very, very important. Verifying often several times, if possible, if the mediation process have been well understood by the stakeholders, and if it's seen as the best available option by the parties. And possible checking with parties what risk they would foresee and what would be the condition for them to feel secure in engaging in the processes. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Ungunan. And I'm really glad that you touched on the risk aversion of humanitarian action, but equally this sort of, how do we build programs and monitor and understand outcomes, especially in the absence of an action? We're talking about interrupting or reducing violence or preventing violence. And I think this is one of the sort of great barriers, particularly when it comes to humanitarian actors, is how do you persuade donors or design programs that then monitor the absence of something happening? I think this is a sort of critical question and one of the key barriers to strengthening this across, particularly in the humanitarian sector. We'll open for a Q&A now and a discussion. We've got huge amounts of expertise, experience in the room and online. So please do sort of come back with your reflections, your questions, but equally sort of if you have any sort of to support what our speakers have said, anything to add to what our speakers have said, but equally a healthy amount of challenge. We're here to, you know, really have an open discussion because we're dealing with some really sensitive and difficult issues here. So we'll open up. I don't know if there's anything online for the time being. We'll take a couple of questions from online and a couple of questions from the room. And then if we have time, go for another 1-2 rounds. So Veronique, I don't know if there's anything online that we can, yeah? Feel free to come up there.
Thank you. I'm Veronique, I work for the Humanitarian Policy Group as well. So we have a couple of online questions. The first one is a recognition, lots of agreement, by the way, on what the panelists were saying. So one question is, indeed, faith-based organizations play a crucial role in building peace, but how do you ensure that the church remains neutral in any issue? So I think that might be very much to the Reverend. And then we have another one, building on experience from Ethiopia, again, acknowledging that preventing and reducing protection risk and violence can be achieved through community engagement, but this can only be achieved and effective through working with grassroots community development organizations, CBOs, and other community organizations. We CSOs have the ways and mechanism to reduce and prevent this inhuman act by government forces and other actors, but we lack the financial and sub-technical support. So what is your approach to supporting local community actors to get more results? So these are the two questions online.
Thanks. Anybody in the room before we go back to panelists? Yep, please go ahead. And please introduce yourselves, where you're from, what your role is when you're coming in on questions. Thanks.
My name is Saba. I'm from Bucks, but my experience is mostly in the Middle East. So I'm sorry, I'm enforcing my experience here. One of the basic challenges I think all of us around the room really struggle to grapple with is how do we convince our donors to meaningfully engage with non-state actors who are sanctioned by those very governments who are our donors? Because if we don't include them in the reconciliation, in the peace, in the dialogue process, we've easily eliminated a third, if not more, of those perpetrators of violence, and also they're also at times attractive for younger generation to be recruited by, specifically talking about militias. And the second question or comment would also be around, we've talked about spoilers, but really the shadow economies around conflict that benefit greatly from perpetuating these conflicts, whether it's governments who, in the case of the Middle East, also bought oil from ISIS, and also, very big corporations, cement companies, oil companies, extracting resources by again, because it's in their interest. So how do we really grapple with that is quite a challenge. And I would really like to pay my compliments to Reverend and Kennedy, very inspiring points that you guys made. Hopefully take them back with me to my context as well.
Yep, go ahead.
Yeah, hello, good morning, everybody. I'm Peter Burgess, and I'm the director of the Interagency Working Group, which is a regional coordination platform of primarily international NGOs. And I'd just like to pick up on the first point of the previous speaker, because that was my point as well, on how does this work in the context of dialogue with either sanctioned or otherwise proscribed groups or individuals. And I think one of the panelists earlier spoke about the whole aspect of dialogue with armed groups introduces risk for the local actors. And I think this may be one which has a particular and a specific risk to external actors, because I think they're more likely to be picked up for engaging with proscribed or sanctioned or organizations or individuals that have been identified or categorized as terrorists. So I think that's the key point there. And I think it's not necessarily only the big obvious groups, but within countries as well, national governments may proscribe opposition armed groups, and that then introduces a risk for local actors. I think in this region, we clearly have that in Sudan at the moment, also Ethiopia. I think Somalia introduces the more international aspect, but something to consider. Thanks.
Thanks very much. Let's pause there and come back to the speakers. So we have a specific question, I think, for yourself, Reverend, on how a faith actor and a church actor, individual leader, remains neutral. Complementarity between grassroots and international external actors. And then this very, very difficult subject that we haven't necessarily touched on today around sort of engagement in the situation of sanctions and proscribed groups, as well as then what is the sort of, the conflict landscape when there are these sort of shadow economies of conflict and violence for economic benefit. So Father Timmy, should we go, Reverend Timmy, should we go to you first, and then feel free to come back?
I think faith-based, I have a prophetic call. And because of that prophetic call, we remain neutral without expressing any interest. That makes it possible for us to be able to mediate or facilitate dialogue. The second one is independence. We should be independent of the conflict, non-judgmental, and to be respected. Out of this is where some community members come specifically. We need reconcile. It's only reconcile that can come in this area. We don't want this other group to come in this area. And that is because of the respect. I've been almost on 3 or 4 occasions captured by armed groups, taken for some time and released based on finding my neutrality, finding the respect as a priest, and this open ways for us to be able to even negotiate release of abductees, negotiate humanitarian access. This is based on being neutral as a faith-based organization. Thank you.
Thank you. All these are interesting questions and of course, very serious challenges. I'll start with the part on the proscribed groups. My first work for almost 10 years was engaging with the Rhodes Resistance Army. And this is a group that was proscribed. And this is a group that did all sorts of heinous actions that you can imagine. It's a big challenge in this, but also there have been a lot of positive developments. For example, it is now generally acknowledged that it's not a crime to talk. So talking to the so-called terrorist or proscribed groups, but with intentions of encouraging them or working with them to get out of violence, I think generally it's acknowledged that it's not a crime. But what is a challenge, and we in the peace building organization, which we have to confront on a day-to-day basis, is how do you then guarantee that you don't intentionally or unintentionally put resources that would enhance their activities? That is the daily challenge which you have to navigate. Even if you are going to set organize a dialogue with them, would you buy them for them water? If you do, are you facilitating their actions or not? And that is a challenge that we have to keep navigating because of the legal sanctions that or legal regime that we are currently working with. But how some of the peace builders have been going around it is to make a distinction between, for example, buying a bottle of water as part of the process of dialogue, but also buying a bottle of water that would go and enhance their actions. But it is a daily struggle and a daily challenge where everybody involved in the process, from funding to selection of participants to individuals that you talk to, where you have to be extremely careful. But as I said, in the case of the Lord's Resistance Army and maybe some of the groups in CAR, later there was a political acknowledgement that this is the only way out. And somehow it worked, but you need to ensure that A, you have very good legal advice, you have good political advice, and you are networking with all the actors, be it in government, be it in the donor community, be it in the UN and others. So it's a bigger challenge now than it was maybe before this regime came up. Now, one of the other challenges, again, to respond to the question that you talked about, to use an example of Central African Republic, the official government position is that there is no way you can talk to some of the individuals in some of the armed groups, for example, those operating in Bosangwa. But at the same time, what is very clear is that the government has no capacity to either militarily defeat those groups or engage with them. So that becomes a challenge. Again, what has happened is to complicate the work for a peace-building intention, individuals with peace-building intentions. And what has been happening is especially the faith leaders, the religious leaders, have been central in terms of creating a bridge between the local communities, individuals in the armed groups that are out there in the bush, and the government. And what I have seen in practice, and as I also saw this in the case of Uganda and the Road Resistance Army, there are always two positions. The official position, don't talk to Road Resistance Army. But when you come to the government with serious and credible analysis and serious and credible agenda, then they say, okay, we can talk. So the question is how to keep navigating these two complex challenges, but also ensuring that you reduce the risks to the individuals you work with, personally, the organization, and others. Shadow economies. This is the elephant in the room. Again, to use the example of Central African Republic, there is a lot of fragmentation of armed groups. And this fragmentation tends to be around an area where there are resources, around the mining site, around a lucrative route where they can levy illegal taxes and whatever. But also when you are, again, 3 years ago, we did an analysis of individuals who had been associated with armed groups. And first, it became apparent that those individuals that were in the armed groups, where they had to reach categories even before they joined armed groups. And therefore, the life they were leading in the armed group was not very significantly different from the life they were leading before joining armed groups. But two, some saw this as an opportunity, as a job, especially when you are promised to be paid in dollars and you think dollars, okay? And 94% of the individuals we talked to had been deceived to join armed groups so that they can be paid in US dollars because they were not having jobs, they were having hard life before. So while looking at the shadow economies or the economics of these conflicts, both from companies and government and illegal taxation and whatever, there is also need to look at it from the individual perspective. What is worse, say in the CAR, these individuals are always lied to that in case we win, you will be a general, you will be a senior government official, even if the person doesn't know how to write their name. And for that matter, the mobilization is around the welfare before, during, and after they've taken over government. And of course, the probability of winning is like 0.00000 something. So what we've been doing as part of the analysis and also as part of networking with both development organization, but also other humanitarian and other actors, is how do you build in livelihoods in the programming that you are doing around peace building, such that some of these individuals, for example, those who are already in the armed groups, how can they develop a bright future or at least a vision for a bright future so that they have something to look up to and something that they can inspire them to even leave an armed group? Thank you.
Thanks so much, Kennedy. And I think that's such an important point that has been touched on by a few people here today of what are the incentives to join? And also, how can you sort of change those calculations? Lee, you spoke to it. Kennedy, you spoke to it. Reverend Tibby, you spoke to it. You know, on sort of changing those calculations and giving alternatives to some of the purposes that violence serves. And I want to also pick up on the point of faith leaders, because I think this is a bit of a misnomer, particularly in the humanitarian space, that faith leaders somehow can't be neutral or independent. Actually, in our experience and research, faith leaders often sit far more neutral than humanitarian actors for sure. Other actors dependent, but it's dependent always on the institution, the individual. And I think that piece on sort of the independence, the respect that you bring, that's an entry point, but then that need to demonstrate that you can truly remain neutral and credible. But I think for those humanitarians on the in the room and on the line, please remember that neutrality is very different than you interpret it through your principled approach, just to give a challenge back. I know we've got a lot of questions on the line, but I just want to give one opportunity because we've got the director of the Centre on Armed Groups, Ashley Jackson, here today, if you want to speak a little bit on sanctions and then we'll go back on questions.
Sure. I mean, I think what Kennedy says in many ways is very, very true, and he speaks from such a rich experience. But I guess coming from the armed group perspective, I would be a little bit more provocative. I mean, one thing I would say is that there's so many ways to engage, and engaging directly is not necessarily the way forward. They may not want to talk to someone they don't know or who presents a threat. So you have to think about these groups as having families, as having economies, as being embedded within communities. And the way is often through businessmen, through their sisters, brothers, through imams, religious figures, whoever it might be. And that's the beginning of how one imperfectly gets to them. I would also say that we have to recognize prescription as a tool of war. And it's a tool of war to achieve a military and political objective by one side against another. And so if we believe in our own neutrality and impartiality, whatever that means, we have to, with tools of war that are harmful, we have to object and advocate for change. And I think it really is important not to take prescription at face value, but to kind of see it as it exists and has been incredibly harmful. I mean, there was this recent edition of Accord that looks at innovation and peace processes. And it was the first time I think I'd seen kind of quant study on the effect of prescription. And it looks at the decline of political mediation, like drastic decline in track one processes over the past 20 years. And the scholars put it down to this, prescription of Islamist groups. And to Kennedy's point about recognize that, you know, what does this bottle of water, is this bottle of water a material support? Well, again, I would say you cannot engage without some risk of providing legitimacy support. You just can't. It's a false premise. And again, it's a tool of shutting down dialogue as a way of defeating a group, right? All of this framework springs from that. And we have to admit to ourselves that engagement, you know, we can't control the impacts of that engagement more widely beyond the objectives. We can mitigate those harmful impacts, but we just did work on Mali, for example. And I think we have to recognize, I mean, in that context, local kind of mediation and ceasefires and pacts with the jihadist groups, a lot of people said it further empowered or emboldened them, right? I think it was probably a realization of what was already happening, but it did achieve community protection aims. So the wider peace building aims in some contexts, or the wider kind of aspirations, we should say, we have to admit that it's complicated and it may exist at odds with these things. They don't always kind of complement, or there are tough choices and difficult to foresee trade-offs, but I should hand back on that note.
Thanks very much. And on that tensions trade-offs, I think such an important point, which for those that are staying for the workshop later, we'll come back to later on. Before we go to the room, I know there's a lot of questions online. So if we can take a couple of questions from online, please, and then we'll come back to the room. Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, we had a lot of questions online, and sorry for those online, I won't be able to put all of them through. But there were three questions that were basically the same, and based on the recognition that, unfortunately, the way funding works is very projectized. So how do you ensure sustainability and continuity of the interventions, in particular when it comes to humanitarian mediation, after the project has ended? Is this a long-term or short-term approach? Then there was a question around the willingness of perpetrators of violence to engage. And when do you know that there is willingness and that the conflict dynamics allows this engagement? When is it possible? When is it not possible? And the question was specifically to humanitarian mediators, but I guess any mediators, how do you know when you can engage? And if I may, the last one was around mitigating risk when engaging spoilers. So how do you mitigate those risks? Thank you very much.
Great, thank you. And back to the room. Go ahead, John.
Okay, good morning. My name is John Malips. I work for PACS under a project called Human Security Survey. I think briefly, I would like to mention a few things. It would be like a reflection, not necessarily a question, but a comments on my own experience also working in South Sudan and also working with communities and armed actors and also doing assessment based on the people's perception and the insecurities that they face in the environment that they live and also peace building at the same time. So I think when we talk of humanitarian and peace building, our meeting point is conflict and violence. That's where I believe that's where people meet. When there's no conflict and violence, there's no concern of humanitarian and peace building. But we have actually facilitated the peace building, a peace dialogue between two communities in South Sudan, the Nuer of Panyinjar County. Panyinjar is one of the counties in Unity State, if some of you know the state of South Sudan. And then the Dinka of Yirul. Yirul is one of the counties in Lake State. So they share a common borders. They share a common border, and then there was a conflict starting from 2013, conflict. That conflict extended 5 years later. And then we intervened as PACS, Human Security Survey, and our partners. We reconcile these communities through all those steps that Mayo mentioned and also the reconcile mentioned. Of course, they are risky, as I saw it before, and that's what we have experienced. We were dealing with the rebels that time before the revitalized agreement signed and the government, which is a bit complicated, you can imagine that. But we managed to break through and reconcile the two communities. My question here is, when we talk of humanitarian and peace building, we know our mandates as organizations, but the civilians, the communities do not know the mandate. When they look at peace building, they call it humanitarian. When they look at humanitarian, they call it peace building. Therefore, my request here is if there is a need for people coming together, these two bodies coming together and they support each other, that one would be very good. Because now peace building is trying to accommodate the element of livelihood, which is not necessarily the mandate of peace building. But of course, when you reconcile communities, conflicts sometimes are being created by poverty, economic issues. Some of the conflicts, not necessarily all the conflicts. But after you reconcile communities, for example, when we reconciled the communities of Panyinjar and Greater Yirul, they became one community. They visit each other. But later on, there was flooding, which displaced communities. They had to come to Greater Yirul, and they stayed there. They need water, they need food. But there was no intervention from humanitarian. As a result of the peace that we made, there was assurance that people live together, but they migrated to this area because there is already peace. Government did not supply them. Humanitarian organization did not supply them. Then the host community became exhausted. There were petty crimes happening there. And then the conflict again, almost resuming. So I'm asking in a meetings like this, let humanitarian organizations also back up the work of peace building, because the peace building work alone cannot solve conflicts, because you reconcile communities and they need livelihood. Of course, even the spoilers, the peace spoilers, I had a question asked later on before that, what can be done about peace spoilers? Even the participant of the conflict who agree to live peacefully, become peace spoilers later on if they don't benefit, because some of the conflict there are people benefiting from it, and you stop the conflict, you say live peacefully, and cattle raiders, for example, they don't do cattle raiding, and that is a business. So there is a need for a humanitarian backing up peace building. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I know we have two hands in the room and we're running against time, so we'll take these two questions and then we'll go back to our panelists. Thank you. Yeah. Please try and keep it a bit short.
Yeah, thank you so very much. My name is James Chemiati. I'm a retired colonel from the Kenya Defense Forces, and I work with the Center for Civilians in Conflict, or CIVIC, if you wish. Briefly, this is a very enriching forum because we are more or less arising from the presentation, cross-pollinating ideas so that then we come up with hybrid solutions that then takes us forward as we do our work as humanitarians. CIVIC has been basically involved in working in DRC Congo, in Goma, but more closely home in Somalia. And I can hear when I listen in that what is happening elsewhere is more or less, we are very, very much related. And in Somalia, we have basically used three approaches. One is capacity building, and this is informed by the research that we did, and the results of which were that most of the harm caused to civilians are actually caused by the government security agents. And so we do capacity building, for example, for the Somalian National Army, to bring them to speed, especially so on matters related to civilian harm mitigation. Similarly, we have assisted previously the AMISOM or ATMIS to come up with what to do with the civilian casualty tracking response analysis cell, so that every casualty or harm that is caused in the field, then it's reported quickly, analyzed, and mitigated to make sure that then we learn from that to inform maybe exercising more precaution. But as I finish, I just want to speak to one area which relates to the topic of today, community engagement. We have gone out there in Somalia, and we have not trained in Mogadishu only. We have actually gone to the field in operational areas and engaged Somali National Army out there. But more importantly too, we have also created the room to engage with the community militias, whom we have sat down, because these are armed groups who have no knowledge of the need to protect civilians, no knowledge of IHL or anything. So we have gone out there in as many locations, had a sitting with them. As many sometimes we go, we train like 100, and then we pull back. And you see at the end of the day, the message that comes out is that this is a training that all of them should be exposed to. And that comes to the issue of sustainability. I think this is the Achilles heel. We go train, exit, and the numbers are many. We can only afford to train so few. So these are just some of the experiences that comes across. We have done this in northern part of Kenya. We have done this one with the East African Community Regional Force that was in Goma. And the feedback we get, so just keep on asking that, please come and tell us more about protection of civilians, civilian harm mitigations. So like the good word says, the harvest is plenty, the laborers are a few. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Victoria Odhiambo, and I work with the Center for Humanitarian Dialogue. I'm a manager on our Sudan program, but I've also worked on our South Sudan program for a while. And I'm just wondering if there are experiences to share where communities who've engaged with non-state armed groups have managed to secure commitments or agreements, and especially when these armed groups have very loose command and control structures, or have loose command and control structures, but also they lack clear chain of command. And of course, on the other side of this question is, especially when the decisions that they're making are also grounded in the conflict dynamics on the ground as the conflict is still happening.
Thanks so much. So we have 6 minutes and I want to give the panelists each a chance to reflect. So if it's okay for anyone in the room and or online, if you have the time, we'll probably go over by a few minutes. If you can keep your answers and your final remarks back to 1-2 minutes. But actually, I think let's go to Ungernan first, and then we can come back to the room. Thanks.
Thank you, Gemma. Talking about the sustainability of the humanitarian mediation outcomes, I'd like to raise that when conducting a humanitarian mediation process, we have many steps in which we ensure that we are conducting the process very well. For example, when we do the conflict sensitive analysis, we ensure that we can identify all the parties to the conflict, and also we can identify connectors and dividers and ensure that we can identify also the inside, the threatful insiders. For example, people in which all the conflict parties are threat, despite the violence, the conflict. So when arrived in at the step of conflicts, separated meetings in terms of pre-mediation sessions prior to the mediation meeting, we do, for example, we do the trainings on peaceful management, conflicts management. We do trainings to, for example, threatful insiders. So that is to ensure that we are empowering the community leaders with how to deal with conflicts when even if our project is ended. And also in terms of sustainability, when we are conducting a mediation process, we still active in, I was talking about that at the beginning of my first question. We ensure an active participation in social cohesion working groups to ensure that the peaceful actors will be able to hand over the process to peaceful actors, and which can ensure that they will be able to conduct a long-term intervention to ensure that the violence will be happen again. We also, in terms of long-term interventions, just to know that at NRC, we see the humanitarian mediation as a first line response to ensure that we can prevent and interrupt violence. So we don't see at NRC, we don't see humanitarian mediation as a long-term intervention. That is why we are working. We ensure an active participation in social cohesion working groups to ensure that we can hand over the process to peaceful actors. That is why I can say thank you.
Wonderful. Thanks, Ungernan. Okay, so let's go along. We're really behind time, so if each of you can keep it to 1 minute, if that's possible.
Yeah, right. Over to you. So thank you, Gemma. So I just wanted to share an experience like how we are looking at the sustainability of our efforts in terms of like protection and peace building. So basically, we have been working with the community structures, existing structures, and where necessary, we involved and we support to establish such type of community structures. So as I mentioned, one of the key component of the UCP strategy is about capacity building. So this is where we are basically engaging with them, trying to build up their capacities in various areas, how they can mediate conflicts and how they can support communities to promote peace among themselves. And this is where also you are talking about like their engagement. I mean, especially when you talk about the community protection teams, we are working with women protection teams and youth protection teams. So we supported them to recognize in the community, especially in the community leadership structures. And they are playing a huge role at the moment. And the recognition has been progressing well. And for instance, I can talk about some of these protection teams are already independently conducting their independent activities within the communities. For instance, like one of the key UCP methodologies about proactive engagement, protective presence and patrols. Right now, they are grouping and they are just doing those type of activities to protect and to reduce the violence, especially like, for instance, like in the water points in the IDP camp settings and women who are going for the firewood collections. So those type of things. Thank you.
Thanks. Nichaya, anything to add? Perfect. Thank you. Reverend Dibby, over to you.
I want to talk about the sustainability, just like my colleague said, is to build the local structures for the ownership. Who are the owners of that peace process? So long as the communities that you engage understand the ownership of the peace, they will be the one to sustain their own peace. You build their capacities to sustain the peace. Women group, religious, traditional leaders, peace committees, to understand how they can continue with engagement in dialogue, continuous engagement, because peace is a process. Mm-hmm. That is the sustainability. The second question of Vicky, non-state actors. It's a very sensitive question. From experience, we engage non-state actors with communities, but this engagement is not within the country. It has to be in a neutral area. You bring these non-state actors, the commanders at all different levels, with the community leaders in outside that country. You mediate with them, you talk with them, you work with them. And in our context, we have heard of many good testimonies between state actors with the community that we are peaceful with this group, but only the government military are the one killing us, are the one destroying our properties, are the one doing this, are the one doing this. In that sense that what has been done with the non-state actors in the community in the neutral area is more sustainable and they are more peaceful. I think that's what I know. Thank you.
Thanks so much. And such an important point on the ownership of communities as well. Kennedy, last word to you before we close.
Okay. Thank you. We all acknowledge the need for complementarity, peace builders, humanitarians, and others. And I think this was a gap that was supposed to be bridged by the triple nexus and the discussion thereof. But somehow it's taken a different direction. So I wonder whether groups like ODI could help in reclaiming that debate and bringing it back to where it is supposed to be. I think that's where one of the fundamental problems currently lie. Number two, on spoilers. I think this is where the whole conflict sensitivity comes in handy and the analysis thereof. We may not necessarily eliminate all the spoilers, but at least we can get strategies on how to mitigate, reduce the impact of these spoilers. On the question around non-state armed groups, in addition to what Reverend Tibi said, I think regular and constant engagement with all the actors, including non-state armed groups, should be paramount and fundamental. Where the challenge lies is that in most of these areas, at least speaking from CAR and DRC lenses, the behavior of governmental forces is as bad as that of the non-state armed groups.
So how do you square it out? That's a challenge for all of us. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Kennedy, and to all of our panelists. I think this has been a really rich discussion, and thanks to everyone also for both in the room and online for taking the time to join us today. But I think it's, yeah, a lot of rich discussion, lots of difficult issues, but also sort of a healthy amount of challenge and solutions. And thanks also for giving us the job of resetting the nexus. No small feat there, Kennedy. But I can assure you that we are attempting to, even though we didn't call this research the nexus, that awful term, I think it has become very apparent of the need, particularly on that peace part of the nexus, of the urgent need to address that peace component. So regardless of the buzz terminology, I'm very much hoping that we can at least make a small contribution with all of your insights and expertise. We'll finish there. Nusim, I will hand over just to close the session, but thanks again so much for all of you in the room and online. I think it's been a really great session. Over to you, Nusim.
Thank you. This has been a very interesting and informative and exciting session. I think we've all learned a lot, and I hope this will be an example of the collaboration, hopefully, between armed actors and peace and humanitarian groups that are working with communities. And I've also learned about, I mean, it's very critical that we take seriously the agency of communities, as we do here at RVI, because one of the mantras, our central mantras and tenets of RVI is how to making local knowledge work. So you're very welcome, and we are very happy that you've been with us. We also want to take this opportunity. My name is Nosim. Have I introduced myself? My name is Nosim Naimasia. I'm the program manager for education and forums. This is one of our forums, and we have other forums that are also engaging and very pertinent in terms of speaking about topics that are very politically important to us in this context. Another department that we also have here at RVI is the education department, where we work with myself and Zainabu Boke, who has been taking pictures of you and doing a lot more today. We also have our executive director, who is seated at the very back. Mark, I don't know if you wanted me to introduce you, but I will. That's Mark Bradbury at the back. He's the ED at RVI. We also have our education sessions program, really. Are very important in terms, because we run courses that address a lot of the issues that we are speaking about here today. And some of the, this year we are having annual courses. We've had annual courses for the last 20 years, a bit more. We've been building on them. And so we have three annual courses every year. They're based on the regions in the continent, the Horn of Africa region, that would cover Somalia, Ethiopia, the northern part of Kenya, and also Djibouti. And then we also have a course on Sudan and South Sudan, importantly, and this would also, hopefully for those who've been in this session, might be interested in attending that course. And then we have of the Great Lakes region. And we hope on, and which would also be part of, you know, I don't know if we've covered CAR, but we certainly work on DRC and the region, Uganda, Burundi, Rwanda. And so we very much would welcome you to learn more about the courses that we're offering. We are downstairs. You can come to the office, you can write to us. We have your email addresses. So yeah, we can send. I hope you will be interested in attending. They'll take part in June and July this year. Yeah, so you're very welcome. And thank you so much again for coming.